Calorama, a Recorded Books Highbridge imprint, presents Until Justice Be Done, America's First Civil Rights Movement from the Revolution to Reconstruction, by Kate Mazur, read by Allison Johnson. Preface. In the summer of 1843, a group of African-American activists in Ohio, among them ministers, teachers, and laborers, convened in the state capital of Columbus with the primary goal of fighting the state's racist laws. Since the first decade of the 19th century, the laws of this free state had construed African Americans as a separate and threatening class of people. Ohio laws prohibited black people from testifying in cases involving whites. The laws required African Americans to register with local authorities, which included paying fees and finding two landowners to promise that they would not become dependent on public resources. These discriminatory laws, which abridged what many considered basic civil rights, were commonly known as the Black Laws. African American men were not permitted to vote in Ohio, despite a declaration in the 1803 Ohio Constitution that all men are born equally free and independent and have certain natural, inherent, and unalienable rights. The Constitution reserved the franchise to white men, leaving Ohio's black residents, just 1% of the total population, at the mercy of the white majority that elected the legislators who wrote the laws. If African Americans wanted state laws to change, they needed to persuade white Ohioans that their cause was just. The result of the 1843 meeting was an address to the citizens of Ohio, written by four men, including A.M. Sumner, a Tennessee-born barber, and George Vachon, the first African-American graduate of Oberlin College. The address called on white Ohioans to recognize the injustice of their laws, insisting that the government's policy toward them was utterly at variance with the promises of the Declaration of Independence. State law should constitute the bulwark of our liberties, the committee declared. And yet Ohio law was employed as the instrument to hunt us down to degradation and shame. The group implored white Ohioans to see the world through their eyes. Their own state denied their fundamental rights, while just to the south, the slave states of Virginia and Kentucky were even worse. Is life secure? Is liberty inviolate? Is the pursuit of happiness left open to us, they asked, when the hand of the ruffians can be raised against our existence with impunity, when the legislatures of adjoining states hesitate not to enact laws which militate against freedom, and the laws of our own state may be construed to deprive us of the enjoyment of liberty? Would the Ohio legislature allow the racist laws to remain, or would voters change course and embrace the principle of racial equality before the law? Across the 26 states that then formed the United States, state legislatures enjoyed enormous authority, and laws that singled out black residents for discriminatory treatment were widely accepted. Writing in 1846, a political season in which repeal of the Ohio black laws took center stage, the Cincinnati Inquirer, a Democratic newspaper, defended the laws with the argument that they were among the many kinds of regulations which may be designed for the protection and peace of the actual settlers of a state. States were entitled to adopt policies that guarded residents against threats of fire, disease, crime, and other kinds of disorder. If the Ohio legislature believed that African Americans threatened the public peace, the Inquirer contended, it was within its rights to impose special regulations designed to discourage them from entering its jurisdiction and to hem them in once they arrived. The push to repeal the Ohio black laws was one revealing episode in a sustained struggle over race and equality that stretched from the nation's founding until the Civil War and beyond. Across the free states, activists forcefully insisted that laws that made explicit race-based distinctions had no place in American life. The movement began in the era of the American Revolution, when demands for citizenship and equal rights for black Americans were part of broader revolutionary currents that emphasized the dignity and fundamental equality of all humanity. Advocates persisted in the period of retrenchment that followed, as states increasingly adopted laws that construed free black people as an unwanted class. They made their case in anti-slavery societies, in the press, and in party politics, where they eventually found a home in the Republican Party. During the Civil War and Reconstruction, Republican majorities in Congress pursued the agenda of racial equality before the law that earlier generations of activists had established. Empowered by the crisis, they passed the nation's first federal civil rights law and the 14th Amendment, which forever changed how Americans understood individual rights and their protection. This sustained struggle against racist laws was America's first civil rights movement. We have often failed to see this movement because our focus was elsewhere, on the origins of the sectional crisis, the great pre-Civil War debate over slavery, or the history of Northern black communities themselves. What we have missed was a struggle for racial equality and civil rights that spanned the first 8 decades of the nation's history, a movement that traveled from the margins of American politics to the center and ended up transforming the U.S. Constitution. The movement encompassed pastors, journalists, lawyers, politicians, and countless ordinary citizens who demanded that the nation's white majority reject racist laws and join the struggle for a better, more just society. Activists mainly advanced their arguments at the state level, where most individual rights were defined and enforced. When they could find a constitutional rationale to do so, they also addressed the federal government, in Congress, and in the courts. They pressed new ideas about citizenship, individual rights, and the proper scope of state power, and their arguments informed the remarkable congressional debates of the 1860s. The movement described in this book was a coalition that encompassed people with a wide array of views. African Americans were at the forefront of the activism and conceived racial equality most expansively. For black people, the urgency was greater than for whites, and so was the danger. It was their children who were denied education, their property that could not be defended in court if they could not testify, and their brothers who might end up in a southern jail while pursuing their livelihoods as sailors. In the decades after the American Revolution, African Americans in the Free States developed activist networks that spanned cities and regions. In newspapers such as New York City's Freedom's Journal and Ohio's Palladium of Liberty, black correspondents and editors denounced racism and advocated racial equality in all areas, not only in what contemporaries understood as basic civil rights, but also in political rights and public accommodations, including railroads, steamships, and hotels. "Repeal all laws and parts of laws that make a distinction on account of color," the Ohio Convention demanded in 1843, "and you will make manifest to the world your love of justice, your hatred of oppression, and your determination to preserve a strict adherence to the great principles of your fathers." The white Northerners who participated in the movement for civil rights in these decades emerged from diverse political orientations, held different beliefs and convictions, and felt varying levels of commitment to the cause. They included radical abolitionists who followed the famous leader William Lloyd Garrison beginning in the early 1830s, but their ranks extended well beyond that. In the states carved from the Northwest Territory, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin, anti-slavery activists made repeal of state-level black laws central to their movement. In the Northeast, particularly in Massachusetts and New York, merchants who did business in the slave states joined committed anti-slavery activists in a struggle for recognition of the civil rights of Northern black sailors who worked in Southern ports. The struggle was arduous. Most white Northerners were indifferent, particularly early on, and the influence of African Americans was limited by black men's inability to vote in most places. The political party system that characterized the antebellum era, a rivalry between the Whigs and the Democrats, did not help. Leaders of both parties were committed to suppressing the sectionally divisive issue of slavery and questions of racial equality, which were almost as volatile. Activists therefore turned to a rich array of political strategies in addition to voting. They organized petition campaigns that drew thousands of women and men into the movement. They lobbied elected officials, writing to them directly or visiting in person. And they worked to shape public opinion by giving speeches and publishing newspapers and pamphlets. All these forms of activism were available, albeit in uneven ways, not just to white men, but also to African Americans and white women. The movement for racial equality and civil rights gradually found purchase in politics by organizing insurgent third parties, and also by pushing to reform existing parties from within. In the mid-1850s, amid a national crisis over the expansion of slavery, the party system defined by the Whig-Democrat rivalry collapsed, and the Republican Party took form. Leaders of this new party, which was based almost entirely in the free states, embraced the movement's long-standing vision for civil rights. Some of them, including Salmon Chase of Ohio and Henry Wilson of Massachusetts, had a long history of pushing for racial equality in their home states. Others, such as Lyman Trumbull of Illinois, had played almost no role in the antebellum struggle, but became reliable advocates during and after the Civil War. The war settled the question of slavery itself, but it resolved nothing about the future of African Americans in the United States. In the war's aftermath, after some 250 years of race-based slavery, the federal government was forced to consider what a post-slavery United States would look like. To which rights were newly freed people entitled? How would those rights be protected? Would the U.S. government step in when state and local officials curtailed people's rights? And if so, under what circumstances? This book demonstrates that the Republicans who led the federal government in that pivotal time had years of experience with such questions. The antebellum North had been in its own way a post-slavery society. At the time of the nation's founding, slavery had been legal almost everywhere, while in the Northwest Territory, where the federal government outlawed slavery in 1787, states quickly adopted policies targeting free black people. Republican leaders of the Civil War generation had witnessed, and in many cases joined, struggles to repeal racist laws and advance the project of racial equality. Those fights gave them a vocabulary and a set of principles that they translated into national policy during and immediately after the war. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 declared African Americans citizens of the United States and promised them the same civil rights as white citizens. The 14th Amendment did that and more, promising equal protection of the law and due process of law to all persons living under U.S. jurisdiction. These measures were the culmination of a decades-long movement that insisted that all people, not just white people, were entitled to protection of their civil rights. Like its successor in the 20th century, there was nothing foreordained about the success of the first civil rights movement. The positions it took were broadly unpopular. Northern Democrats, in particular, moved easily from traditional concerns about the economic dependency of formerly enslaved people to visions of black criminality and racial inferiority. Many white Northerners who considered themselves forward-thinking on issues of race and slavery believed that the United States was destined to be a white nation in which free African Americans would never truly have a place. Among them were supporters of the American Colonization Society and its decades-long drive to persuade free black people to emigrate to Liberia. At the same time, many white Americans viewed laws designed to constrain and marginalize free black people as entirely justifiable within a broader legal and cultural tradition that encouraged state and local governments to regulate groups of people who were construed to be dependent and potentially disruptive, including paupers, vagrants, wives, and children. The movement for racial equality confronted all these ideas about race and government while also adapting itself to the constitutional order in which it operated. The American Revolution had bequeathed to Americans the Declaration of Independence and its ringing promise that all men are created equal. But the Revolution had also given the nation the Constitution, a blueprint for governing that gave state and local governments tremendous power over the status and rights of their inhabitants. In a world that was anything but egalitarian, states were empowered to legalize a host of coercive practices designed to control and manage groups considered to be dangerous or destabilizing. Legislators wrote laws targeting the transient poor and allowing paupers and vagrants to be expelled from communities at will. They construed married women and children as dependents of their husbands and fathers, denying them rights and limiting their liberty. Most germane to the activists described in this book, they passed race-based regulations that not only legalized slavery itself, but also targeted free black people and Native Americans. People seeking to challenge such oppressions found little support in the first 8 amendments to the Constitution, now known as the Bill of Rights. Although those amendments, adopted in 1791, enumerated a variety of individual rights, the prevailing view was that they were designed to limit the power of the federal government, not the states. Movement activists made their case in constitutional terms anyway. They focused much of their energy at the state level. Sometimes they adopted the language of legal personhood, other times the concept of citizenship. Both had constitutional foundations, personhood in the Bill of Rights and citizenship in the Constitution's Privileges and Immunities Clause, Article 4, Section 2. They directed their claims at courts when they could. But state courts were immensely deferential to legislatures, and getting a case about the rights of free African Americans into federal court proved exceedingly difficult. Many of the most important debates about race and civil rights, therefore, occurred in meetings, newspapers, and political venues. State legislators, activist lawyers, and everyday people all engaged with constitutional questions, some challenging and others accepting what legal authorities had to say. Congress was also a crucial site for constitutional interpretation. This was evident during the Missouri crisis of 1819 through 21, as well as on the several occasions when it debated legislation to enforce the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and when, after the Civil War, it decided that the Constitution must be dramatically altered. What brought the disparate groups of people in this movement together was a commitment to racial equality and what they often termed civil rights. For Americans of the early 19th century, civil rights were basic or fundamental rights associated with being a free person. Virginia Congressman Philip P. Barber, who later became a Supreme Court justice, described civil rights in 1820 as the rights of personal liberty and the free possession and enjoyment of personal property. These were rights associated with the abstract promises of life, liberty, and property handed down from English common law and referenced in the Declaration of Independence. Adding specificity, Barber's contemporaries would have mentioned the rights to enter into contracts, sue and be sued, testify in court, and more generally, to receive protection from the law. Most Americans of this era distinguished civil rights from political rights, which included the rights to vote, hold office, and serve on juries. The majority believed political rights were more like privileges, reserved for a subset of people charged with making decisions for the whole community. Some of the white Americans who joined the movement to secure civil rights for free African Americans wanted to go no further than that. They did not support racial equality and political rights, or they did so only reluctantly, when pushed by the force of the Civil War and the need to reconstruct the nation. That cohort was, in a sense, the movement's lowest common denominator, a part of the coalition that was both critically important and, at times, frustratingly timid. The first civil rights movement had proponents and leaders in every free state, but this book focuses on several locales that stand out for their significance in the broader struggle. The states carved from the Northwest Territory are of particular interest, because it was there that the experiment with barring slavery while permitting racially discriminatory laws took hold most firmly. Ohio is especially prominent as the first state created from the Northwest Territory and the first to adopt anti-black laws. It remained the most populous Old Northwest state throughout this period and was home to the largest black population and the most robust abolitionist movement. Ohio was also the Old Northwest state where the movement against racist laws was most successful. The history of Illinois offers a counterexample, showing how Democrats continued to mobilize to bar black migration and deny black citizenship in the 1850s, but also how the nascent Republican Party staked out a very different position. Early on, Philadelphia and New York City emerged as centers of African-American activism, places where abolitionists cultivated and sustained the vision of universal rights represented by the Declaration of Independence. The states of New York and Massachusetts also loom large, because there, agitators, together with legislators, made the most consequential arguments that free African Americans were state citizens, entitled to enjoy the privileges and immunities of citizenship promised by the Constitution's Article 4, Section 2. Massachusetts activists and politicians supporting African-American sailors working in southern ports invoked the Privileges and Immunities Clause to insist on the right of free African-Americans to move freely from one state to another. At the end of the 1830s, the Massachusetts legislature instructed the governor to use public funds to rescue black citizens from southern jails. In the early 1840s, legislators succeeded in getting Congress involved in the issue. Washington, D.C. is essential to this story, both as the seat of the U.S. government and because of its anomalous constitutional status. Activists often pushed the struggle for racial equality into the halls of Congress, seeking to publicize their agenda and provoke outsized reactions from Southern legislators. At the same time, because the Constitution placed the District of Columbia under the exclusive jurisdiction of Congress, civil rights advocates frequently made it a target, especially by demanding respect for the rights of free black Northerners who traveled there. Still, efforts to bring the question of racial equality before federal authorities, Congress as well as the courts, were only marginally successful in an era in which Southern slaveholders held disproportionate power in Washington. In the free states by 1860, the movement for racial equality was on solid ground, but it was the cataclysm of the Civil War that gave Republicans an opportunity to implant their vision in federal policy. When the Republicans of 1865 and 1866 crafted the language of the 14th Amendment, which explicitly limited the power of the states, they were tackling a problem they knew well. Many had long opposed racially discriminatory laws in the states and wanted to ensure that the Constitution barred such laws forever. When they included in the amendment the language of privileges or immunities and referenced both state and federal citizenship, they were trying to resolve problems that had long bedeviled Northerners who demanded respect for the rights of free African Americans. Yet the unprecedented federal civil rights measures also had their limits, and this book helps explain those, too. Why did Republicans resist the argument that new promises of equality should encompass sex as well as race? Why did they not address the anti-vagrancy laws and other race-neutral measures that targeted poor people and remained so effective in limiting the freedom and opportunities of black Americans? And why, even after the new measures passed, did states retain such expansive powers to oppress? The end of explicitly racist laws did not mean the end of racist law enforcement, much less the end of racism itself. That much remains terribly clear. Yet the first civil rights movement changed America. The movement advanced a vision of racial equality that, despite the ideals set forth in the Declaration of Independence, had never been pursued or widely accepted in state or federal policy. Its most enduring consequence, the 14th Amendment, became a bulwark for individual rights. It is the constitutional foundation on which generations of people living in the United States have built their demands for equal protection and due process of law, and on which Americans have made claims to birthright citizenship. The movement's accomplishments are all the more impressive if we consider the immensity of the opposition. Those who fought for racial equality and civil rights confronted deeply ingrained convictions about white racial superiority that originated in centuries of African slavery and native dispossession. Moreover, to secure federal protections for the rights of vulnerable individuals, the movement challenged American federalism and its tradition of allowing states to determine the status and rights of their residents. In every generation, those who have waged such struggles have encountered staunch, often violent, resistance. The people portrayed in this book persevered, acting on the conviction that we are better off without racist laws than with them, and better off struggling for justice in a multiracial society than rejecting the possibility that one could exist. Chapter 1. On the Grounds of Expediency and Good Policy. Free State Anti-Black Laws in the Early Republic. John Burns was one of thousands of African-American Virginians who made his way north across the Ohio River in the early decades after American independence. For Burns, it was not a simple process. In late November 1813, he visited the clerk of Augusta County, Virginia, and secured papers certifying that he was a free man by birth, raised in the county, and a man of good character. 3 days later, a justice of the peace issued Burns a paper that declared the clerk's document authentic. Burns then received yet another document. It was a pass, signed by the clerk, that linked his name with his physical attributes. The pass read, "John Burns, of dark yellow complexion, about 30 years of age, 5 feet 10 inches high, born free and by trade a shoemaker, requested in said office this day." 12 months later, Burns was more than 300 miles from home. He had crossed the Allegheny Mountains and the Ohio River into the free state of Ohio. His papers would have served him on his journey, allowing him to prove that he was a free man entitled to his liberty. In slaveholding Virginia, dark skin color or the appearance of being a person of African descent were considered prima facie evidence of enslaved status. The burden was on the person of color to produce evidence that he or she was free. What could Burns expect in Ohio? North of the Ohio River, slavery had been outlawed by the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. The Ohio Constitution of 1803 strongly disavowed slavery, but state laws passed in 1804 and 1807 required that free black people register with county officials and, in a host of other ways, established that African Americans could not expect the same freedoms as white residents of Ohio. Burns arrived in Chillicothe, then the state capital of Ohio, and presented his papers to the county clerk of Ross County. The law required not only that African Americans register, but also that they get 2 landowners to pledge to pay up to $500 in expenses should the black registrant prove unable to support him or herself. The Ross County clerk registered Burns, even though he did not have those sureties. The clerk copied the text of Burns's papers into the record book, and with that, Burns became a legal resident of the county. Free African Americans like John Burns, who sought to migrate from slave states to free ones, made the southern reaches of the Northwest Territory a battleground in a decades-long struggle over race and civil rights. In slaveholding states, the free black population grew dramatically during and after the American Revolution. Maryland and Virginia, in particular, loosened their manumission laws, and enslaved people became free either by working to purchase themselves and family members or through the good graces of their owners. In Virginia, the U.S. Census counted 12,866 free African Americans in 1790. 10 years later, that population had increased to 20,124. But legislatures quickly moved to curtail that trend. In the 1780s and 1790s, the Virginia General Assembly passed laws that required free black people to register with local officials and observe special curfews, barred free African Americans from testifying in cases involving whites, meted out harsher criminal penalties for blacks than whites, and banned certain kinds of interactions between enslaved and free black people. In 1793, Virginia became the first state to pass a law that banned free African Americans from migrating into the state. Retrenchment in the slave states coincided with growing American settlement north of the Ohio River. During the colonial period, slavery had put down roots in some areas of that immense expanse, particularly where French traders clustered in places such as Detroit and towns just east of the Mississippi River in the Illinois country. Under American rule, however, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 outlawed slavery in the region. Many white settlers who moved to the area were drawn there precisely because they wanted to avoid living amid human bondage. But as Virginia and the more recently settled state of Kentucky cracked down on free African Americans, white settlers north of the Ohio River increasingly feared that free black people would choose to migrate into free territory, and they took action to discourage it. From the outset, settlers in the Old Northwest adopted laws that imposed special regulations on free African Americans. The black laws of Ohio required migrants like John Burns to register with county officials and post bonds designed to ensure that they would not become dependent on public relief. They barred African Americans from testifying in court cases involving white people.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?